Welcome to All About Agatha, the podcast dedicated to reading and ranking every single mystery novel written by the Queen of Crime, Dame Agatha Christie. I'm Catherine Brobeck.
I'm Kemper Donovan.
And this week, we are coming back to one of our favorites.
We're back, baby. And oh, how are we back? It is time for some Mr. Quinn and Mr. Satterthwaite.
My heart goes pitter-pat, and it's not just the slight arrhythmia.
We have to admit, we advertised this episode as falling on Valentine's Day because we will be covering the short story The Love Detectives, which falls outside of the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection, one of those two outlier stories. We did not make it in time for Valentine's Day, alas, but you know what? Love is in the air all the time.
And as is the flu.
As is the flu. How are you feeling, Catherine?
You know, much better.
What would be more Mr. Quinn than doing a story that was meant to be scheduled on one date for an entirely different one? He does not follow convention. He's here, there, and everywhere. So perhaps this was meant to be. And yes, as I just mentioned, we will be covering The Love Detectives on this episode. Catherine Brobeck, can you tell us a little bit about the publication history of the story?
Right. So it was first published in October of 1926 in the U.S. in Flynn's Weekly, then in December of 1926 in the Storyteller magazine in the U.K., both under the title At the Crossroads. The version in the Storyteller was called The Magic of Mr. Quinn Number 1 at the Crossroads.
I have a little bit of extra intel about that because we've mentioned that series before, the Magic of Mr. Quinn series in magazine form. And yeah, this was the first within that series. It's interesting because there was a first batch of Mr. Quinn stories that came out in Grand Magazine in 1924 and 1925. And then this was the second batch of six stories that came out in the Storyteller magazine as the Magic of Mr. Quinn series, at least in the UK. And unlike the Grand Magazine stories, which came out a lot more sporadically, and Christie kind of referenced that in her autobiography, how she wrote them when she wanted to, these came out quite regularly, which I thought was interesting. I didn't realize that until delving into this a little bit, but they came out once a month for 6 months. So it seems as though she must have written them beforehand, or at least have done the majority of the writing before they were coming out. Although who knows with Christie,
she could probably
write them in like 2 hours if she wanted to. But because this is the first in a new series and it had been a beat since Mr. Quinn's stories had been published in a different magazine, she kind of is working overtime to connect this story to the previous run of Mr. Quinn stories. It's kind of beside the point to what's actually happening in the story. But we get this reference to At the Bells in Motley, which was the last Mr. Quinn story published in Grand Magazine a little over a year before this one. And then we also get a reference to the first story that was published in that Grand Magazine run, which was The Coming of Mr. Quinn. So I just thought that was interesting that you can feel the serialization of the story with those references.
Well, and you know, that goes perhaps a little bit of a ways to explaining why in The Magic of Mr. Quinn, of the six of them, guess which one was left out of the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection?
Yeah, this one.
Yep, this one.
Yeah, and this is really the only Mr. Quinn story to be left out of that collection because the second outlier Mr. Quinn story was written much, much later, decades after the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection came out. And we'll be covering that one, you know, at the very end of our podcast, whenever that is, you know, 30 years from now. But it is interesting that for whatever reason, Christie or the publishers or someone chose not to collect this one. I'm not sure why, because I'll just say it here. I mean, this to me was a standard Mr. Quinn Satterthwaite story that functions as many of them do and hits all the kind of bells and whistles we're used to these stories hitting.
Yeah, I mean, the stakes oddly feel lower for some reason, even though they aren't. We can talk about it later.
Yeah.
There's something tonally slightly odd, which is a funny thing to say about Mr. Quinn stories, given that they're all tonally odd. But I kind of understand maybe why it was left out. It still seems weird. Like, why not just put it in there anyway?
It seems totally weird to me. I mean, yeah, I think maybe let's talk more about it when we're on the other side of our breakdown. But I'd be curious to hear if other listeners have an opinion or an argument, some sort of a hypothesis as to why this one in particular was left out, because I'm not sure that I do, but maybe when we get there, it will make a little more sense. So as we just mentioned, since of course this wasn't published within the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection in the 30s, it wasn't published in the UK until Problem at Polenta Bay and Other Stories, which is that grab bag we've talked about before. That was in 1991. And in the US, it was collected much earlier. What would that collection be, and when was it published, Catherine?
It would have shown up in Three Blind Mice and Other Stories in 1950.
All right. Well, let's move right along to our victim, who is Sir James Dwighton, quote, veering on 60 with grizzled hair and a florid face, reputed to be tight-fisted in the extreme. He is bashed over the head with a 2-foot-long bronze statue in his home of Alderway. This is a proper murder mystery.
It is.
Who are our suspects, Catherine?
Well, we have the Lady Dwighton, who's beautiful, like a Renaissance Madonna. She was a once upon a time actress who...
A what?
I'm sorry. Did you not hear that, Kemper? She's an actress.
All right.
Just something to keep in mind. Intruder alert. Intruder alert. Intruder alert. Intruder alert. She's married to the much older Sir James. Also, might want to note the much older aspect, especially because she's rumored to have a flirtation with who, Kemper?
The dashing Paul de Langua, who is dark and handsome, although not in a foreign way. That is noted. Not in a foreign way.
Definitely noted.
And he has recently been kicked out of Alderway, which is suspicious. Perhaps it has to do with said flirtation.
Perhaps. And then we have Jennings, the valet. Maybe he'd been acting suspiciously. Maybe he'd been stealing, and he had been seen in the study around the time of Sir James's death.
And then we have the butler, who found the body, but apparently doesn't have a name.
And we have Jane, the lady's maid.
All right. Pretty short list of characters there, but it is a short story after all. Let's move right along into the world as it appears to be. We open on Mr. Satterthwaite.
Oh, and Mr. Yes, Satterthwaite.
We're so happy. He is sitting with a Colonel Melrose, who is the county's chief constable, and I believe a character we've come across before in one of the Christie Crown Jewels, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, as the chief constable there. Given that The Murder of Roger Ackroyd was published in 1926, and this short story was first published in 1926, I'd say it's a safe bet that Christie did that on purpose, and that this is, in fact, the same person. Interestingly, Colonel Melrose is also name-checked in Sleeping Murder, which is Christie's last published novel. We'll get there eventually. Though Melrose doesn't appear in the novel itself, the detective in that case says that Miss Marple was once pointed out to him by a Colonel Melrose, who had met Miss Marple in the course of the investigation into the murder of Lucius Prothero. And that murder, of course, features in The Murder at the Vicarage, which is Miss Marple's first novel. However, Christie probably meant to say Colonel Melchett here in Sleeping Murder when she was referencing the chief constable in Murder at the Vicarage, because Colonel Melchett is, in fact, the chief constable who features in that novel. In any case, Mr. Satterthwaite and Colonel Melrose are old friends. Their fathers knew each other, and that is why they still spend time together, because otherwise they don't have a whole heck of a lot in common or
not
much to say.
At all. I mean, I'm assuming that Colonel Melrose is not hanging around on the Riviera with, you know, many a duchess.
Yeah. I believe that was the similar situation in Harlequin's Lane, the last story of the Mr. Quinn collection as well. His friendship with the boring husband also was one of circumstance due to their childhood connection. So, you know, Mr. Satterthwaite has a wide acquaintance, and it's not all duchesses. Some people he sees out of obligation because he has to, not because he wants to.
Well, and also, as we find out, he knows who every single person involved in this story is. So.
Yes, he does. So he is having a bit of a boring time there with Colonel Melrose when, the phone rings. And it is Inspector Curtis alerting him to the murder of Sir James at Alderway, our victim. And Inspector Curtis says that the colonel must rush over right away. He's needed. And of course, Colonel Melrose invites along Mr. Satterthwaite.
Let me get some background details from Mr. Satterthwaite about this family. We've gone over some of them, right? Satterthwaite seems to know many, many a detail about Sir James being sort of disliked and his wife's fine performing skills on the stage. Satterthwaite has seen her perform. Satterthwaite is kind of enamored by how beautiful she is.
I'm not sure if it's during this car ride, but at some point in the story, we're told that Lady Dwighton has never had her hair cut.
Right.
Which is interesting.
She wraps it around her ears and then ties it in a chignon, like at the base of her neck.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just imagining some really massive split ends, but to each his own. You gotta trim a little bit. Come on. You gotta
Well, it's very much 19th century paintings and Ophelia and yes. Lady of Shalott. And
yes, pre-Raphaelite kind
absolutely
of.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So. The posters that like everyone had in their college dorm.
Oh my right? gosh. Yeah.
Either Ophelia drowning or Lady of Shalott, et cetera, et cetera.
I was perhaps not that romantic.
My college dorm, I had a poster of the Gwyneth Paltrow Emma. I remember that very clearly in my freshman dorm. Oh my God. I would also just like to point out, since we are back to a Mysterious Mr. Quinn story, that in the first paragraph of this short story, we have Mr. Satterthwaite being called an onlooker at life. It's like, at this point, it's almost a mantra, the way that Christie has to hit Mr. Satterthwaite being an onlooker at life, and then Mr. Quinn being dressed in motley colors and looking like a harlequin. It's so comforting to me at this point. Like, reading the story, I was just like, oh my God, I'm just so cozy, you know?
Well, I just immensely like his inane details about the history of these families and like the etymology of their surname, etc.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's all just like very, very Mr. Satterthwaite and as a result, lovely.
Very lovely. And something really exciting, but also perhaps that we are expecting happens next. What happens, Catherine?
Well, they're speeding along this main road to Alderway, and they're almost wiped out by a car at a, wait for it, crossroads that's coming onto the main road from a smaller one. That car spins out, basically, and the colonel, when they come to a stop, exits to help the other car and its occupants. Turns out it's going to be some time before the other car can be fixed. Satterthwaite finally gets out of the car, he joins them, and he recognizes the passenger of the other car. Because guess who it is, Kemper?
Poirot?
Oh, well, I'd probably be even more excited in that case. But no, it's not Poirot. It is one Mr. Harley Quinn. And guess what? There are some also brake lights involved, Kemper.
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, a car accident meet cute for these two. I think this is the best meetup of Quinn and Satterthwaite in any of the stories. I'm actually shocked that this was not included in the collection. I think it's an outrage because this just tickled me. And I also, yes, so as I mentioned, the other beat that Christie always has to hit here in these stories is Mr. Quinn's appearance, right? And this is one of the best yet. I've got to pull it out of the text. By a curious effect of light, the headlights of one car and the red taillight of the other, Mr. Quinn seemed for a moment to be dressed in motley himself. But it was only the light. Oh, Agatha!
I
never
also
change. And she
I also
never did.
No. I also like the reference. Oh, Bells and Motley. That's quite an odd name for a pub.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, well, once upon a time, it wasn't so odd.
So, of course, Mr. Satterthwaite invites Mr. Quinn to come along to Alderway. And that is where we find our very deceased victim, who is very much bludgeoned over the head. And the study in which he was killed is a bit of a mess. There is a broken clock. It is on its side. This was sort of like a standing desk clock. And it puts the time of the crime very obviously at 6:30, because that is the time that it reads when it presumably was broken. And the colonel is just immediately unhappy by how obvious that seems. It perhaps
although the
feels...
the inspector was very happy about it.
The inspector is of the Inspector Slack school.
Right. Yeah.
In that if something seems like it's pointing to an obvious solution, he's like, let's go with that.
Right. In fact, that's actually partially why Satterthwaite is brought along.
Right, because he knows that Satterthwaite is going to be able to see behind things and underneath things and see things a little bit differently, right? Because
mm-hmm.
he is, you know, a looker on of life.
To
I don't
life.
Know if you knew that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Did you know that?
No, I never heard that, Kemper.
Yeah, he observes. He doesn't really act.
Oh, is that?
But in observing, he's actually lived more than many people who are much more active. If that makes sense, I don't know.
I mean,
it's a very new concept, so I'm not sure.
I don't know. It's like we're getting it thrust upon us in this story, and I'm having a very hard time putting my mind around it. You know,
wrapping your head around that concept. I might need her to repeat it a couple more times before it really sinks in. In any case, around the same time as all this business is going on with the desk clock, Mr. Satterthwaite pockets a sliver of curved broken glass that he finds.
Yeah, Mr. Satterthwaite has apparently not watched any CSI or read anything about meddling with crime scenes.
Unless, you know, the conspiracy theory is that he did it all along and he was trying to cover up his tracks.
No, I mean, Fight Club Satterthwaite.
All right, what happens next, Catherine?
So we have a bunch of interviews. They interview the butler, who found the body at 7 when he was closing the curtains. And by the way, there are locked windows. Of course, they're locked from the inside. He'd previously seen Lady Dwighton head to the study at around 6:30, suspiciously. Then they interview Jennings, the valet, who had brought in slippers and left around 6:15 and went back to the steward's room where he had been from 6:20 until 7. And this is witnessed by other people. The inspector's already asked. And at 7, he's gone back to the study when the butler called him.
Next up is Lady Dwighton of the long hair wrapped around her body, and she shakes like a delicate, fragile flower before abruptly telling the colonel that she did it. She killed her husband by shooting him in the head. She says this while fretting with this book that she's carrying, out of which falls a beautiful dagger / letter opener. She's been using it as a bookmark. I get that. I use some curious things as bookmarks sometimes.
I've used like food as bookmarks before.
I just recently, which is why it sticks in my head, I shouldn't be admitting this. I recently used an apple core as a bookmark just because like there was nothing around and I had just finished an apple and I only put it in there for like a minute. So many listeners are going to be horrified by that, but I promise it wasn't a library book.
Yeah, I was about to say, if it was a library book, we would have to like string you up, but you know, if it's your own book, it's totally fine. Yeah, I mean, just terrible things. Like socks off the floor.
Unspeakable things.
Unspeakable things I've used as bookmarks.
Well, I also dog ear, so, you know.
I'm not a dog earer. I can't do it. I can violate the pages with used dental floss, but not dog earing.
I write in the margins.
That's
pages. Different.
I don't like dog earing because then the pages, if you have to go back to something, then it gets confusing because some of the pages are dog eared.
I know what you mean. I like how it looks very used and crinkly afterward.
And how it's stained with apple.
Yes, and how it apparently has apple juices and little cyanide seeds. So the men are all shocked by her confession. She dramatically weeps, and then the colonel sends her up to her room.
So next to be interviewed is, you know, that very glamorous Paul Delangua.
But not foreign.
Not foreign. Just very darkly handsome and English. Of course, English. He, upon walking into the room, also immediately confesses. Because, you know, you see he stabbed Sir James, and then he looks shocked when he looks down at this table where Lady Dwighton had left her book and where that dagger / letter opener had fallen out. And he points to it and he says, "And that is the murder weapon." And at this point, all of the men in the room are essentially like, come on, really? Lady Dwighton's brought back, and when they see each other, they're both like, darling, how could you have done this, darling? And then the other's like, no, but you did it. And it's very, very melodramatic, shall we say. The colonel notes that it's like a romance novel, and he basically tells them to knock it off because clearly they're both lying.
Right. They're all shocked by Lady Dwighton's confession, but they all know that it's fake since obviously he was hit over the head, not shot. And same thing with Paul Delangua's confession. They're both bogus confessions on their face.
Right. And so essentially the colonel's just like, calm down, you both. We clearly understand that you're lovers. Tell us what actually happened.
Right. He asked them to come clean. So Lady Dwighton, still in her dramatic fashion, does so. And she notes that she did go into the study a little before 6:30, let's say about 6:25, and she found her husband already dead. And she was convinced that her beloved Paul must have done it, since they are, of course, carrying on an affair. And she shut the door and she ran away. But wait, we have that broken clock, which was stopped at 6:30, right? So Lady Dwighton's evidence here is proving that Colonel Melrose was correct not to have trusted that clock, saying that the murder happened at 6:30, because she's saying, no, it definitely happened before 6:30. So now they know that someone must have tampered with that clock. And there's also this bit of demonstration where they show that the clock really couldn't have fallen over on its own. It was too kind of
right. They hit the table very angrily over and over again.
Right. It has a solid base, so it really never would have tipped over. So it clearly someone just took it and smashed it and turned it onto its side. So that time becomes meaningless of 6:30. So now the issue becomes, well, when did this murder happen? And Lady Dwighton chimes in. See what I did there?
I did see what you did there, Kemper. And would you like a slow golf clap?
You might have seen what I did there, but that doesn't mean that you have to like it. So she has some more info, conveniently, which is that her late husband actually wore a golf watch. And maybe, just maybe, that watch got smashed when he fell forward after getting hit over the head. And in that case, that would, of course, fix the true time. And Colonel Melrose has Inspector Curtis go fetch the watch. And when the colonel opens it, hey, it has been smashed. And the time on it reads 6:15. That means the murder must have happened at 6:15. Jennings at this point is in a bit of hot water because, as these two lovebirds inform everyone, there is a rumor that Jennings had been stealing from his master and that he was about to be fired. And he does not have an alibi at 6:15.
Because that was when he dropped the slippers off.
That was when he dropped the slippers off. He was, in fact, by his own evidence, at the scene of the crime when apparently it was committed. So, at the end of the world as it appears to be, it seems that our murderer is Jennings, the valet. I suppose case closed.
Yeah, great. And then the two lovebirds, as kooky as they are, can, like, go run off together.
Right, they've been saved, and as we've come to expect in a Mysterious Mr. Quinn story, that is often the purpose that Mr. Quinn serves, right? And he's the catalyst who uses Mr. Satterthwaite's observational powers.
In fact, that's even how Satterthwaite introduces him to the colonel, right? That he is somebody who, you know, is very invested in mysterious love connections.
Yeah. And you know what? That reminds me, I didn't mention it, but just one other aspect of that meet-cute between Mr. Quinn and Satterthwaite. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of mooning over each other about how wonderful the other person is. And at one point, Colonel Melrose, he's, quote, clearing his throat uncomfortably.
I know.
Mr. Quinn's like, my dear Satterthwaite, you're making me blush. And Mr. Satterthwaite's like, oh, Mr. Quinn. And Colonel Melrose is like, do you need me to leave?
Right. And then instead, Satterthwaite's like, no, he should get in the car with us.
So yeah, also, this all seems to be wrapped up, except of course we are in an Agatha Christie puzzle mystery. So we've got some clues to bridge us over to the world as it actually is.
We do. Given this is a Mr. Quinn story, I wouldn't say there is much in the way of clues here, but you know, there are some. The first one, I just have to reiterate this with a giant, giant sigh. But clue number one, actors.
Actors.
Again, we're told Satterthwaite has seen Lady Dwighton on the local stage and that she was really marvelous. On top of that, she has a sort of persona that she dresses in, you know, her hair, etc. And as we're told repeatedly, her entrance and her confession were very dramatic. And I mean, the deduction here is, I don't really think I have to say anything else. It's actors. She's up to something.
The actor did it. To give the story credit, it is a little bit more complicated than that. That is partially
not partially true.
All right. Clue number two is that shard of glass that Mr. Satterthwaite picked up. Especially in a short story, it's so highlighted and so obviously an object of importance that, you know, an astute reader is going to realize that this must mean something. And the deduction here is, well, what has broken glass in it?
There's a reference made to the glass over the face of the golf watch being, quote, cracked across, end quote. And that reference should perhaps send an astute reader back to Christie's description of the desk clock, a, quote, big dark enamel clock, end quote, which Christie never describes as having glass over it or being cracked in any way. It's merely on its side. Nothing else made of glass is referenced as having been broken in the room, so that must mean that the shard of glass comes from the golf watch.
We should mention yet again, the golf watch is in a case.
Yes. So if it were a shard from the golf watch, that would certainly be very interesting, wouldn't it?
It definitely would be. So that ties right into clue number three, which is another favorite, and it's timing. Temporal obfuscation is a very, very beloved trick of Christie's. And with all this focus on time, especially in a short story, we, as Christie readers, know that something's up here. So we have four times that we're dealing with. We're dealing with 6:15, which is the golf watch. That's when it stopped. We have 6:20 when the valet has an alibi starting. We have 6:30, which is when Lady Dwighton was seen entering the study and also the same time as the main clock stopped. And then we have 7 o'clock. When the body was found.
Right.
So we have four different times that we're dealing with in a, you know, few short pages.
Totally. And at the end of the world, as it appears to be, we're essentially told that the murder had to have happened at 6:15. So I think our sort of simple deduction is no, it didn't.
Right. Yeah.
It must be more complicated than that. Right. And you know what? I'm actually going to throw in a clue number four just for kicks, little meta clue here. We mentioned, oddly enough, very much in passing, that Colonel Melrose as a character was in Murder of Roger Ackroyd, but then also in Sleeping Murder, the character of Colonel Melrose apparently is referenced as someone who Miss Marple knew back when the case at Murder at the Vicarage was taking place.
Right.
He doesn't appear within the novel Murder at the Vicarage,
no,
but he's referenced in Sleeping Murder vis-a-vis the Murder at the Vicarage case. And do you know what the puzzle mystery in Murder at the Vicarage has in common with the puzzle mystery here in this story?
Oh, I think you should tell us, Kemper.
Everything.
Yeah.
It's the same puzzle mystery.
It's the same puzzle mystery. Exactly.
It's just the super simple version. And she obviously came up with the super simple version 4 years before she did the much, much, much more elaborate and entertaining version in Murder at the Vicarage. I know some people don't like when we spoil other novels and stories in our discussions, so skip ahead 15 to 30 seconds here if you don't want Murder at the Vicarage to be spoiled. But Murder at the Vicarage involves a pair of lovers, each of whom confesses to the murder and then cancels out each other's confessions only at the end of the novel to, in fact, be the co-conspiring murderers.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just keep that in mind here, the similarities, even just on their face between that story and Murder at the Vicarage, I think we reach our solution and let's stop being coy about it and solve this case.
All right. So Satterthwaite and the Colonel start to realize that Mr. Quinn's not really joining their good cheer of having caught, you know, the murderous Jennings and solving this crime. And realizing this, Satterthwaite gets on edge and he begins to prod Mr. Quinn, and Mr. Quinn prods him back until it becomes obvious, which is, surprise, surprise, Lady Dwighton and Paul conspired to kill Sir James. Paul killed him, but Lady Dwighton was right there with him.
And all that business with the clocks, this happened at 6:30.
Right.
Or thereabouts. And they smashed the desk clock at that time. And that's why it read 6:30. And then they opened up the watch, smashed it, at which point a little sliver of glass fell out of it since they were tampering with the watch, and set the time back to 6:15 to implicate Jennings, the valet.
Right. Then they both dramatically confess to save the other, messing up the details and making it look like a romance novel gone awry, thus removing the suspicion from each other. Oh, well, you know, they're clearly covering, so they clearly must not have done it, whereas otherwise they'd be the obvious suspects. The wife and her lover would be the obvious suspects.
Totally. And they also were extra devious by not just smashing the desk clock and setting that back to 6:15, because the tampering with that clock just seemed so obvious that that's why they kind of did this double tampering ploy by putting that at 6:30. And the truly important time tampering that they did was with the watch, which seemed less obvious, even though, as Mr. Quinn points out, it was the lady's suggestion to
look at it.
Watch. Yeah.
The really, really smart suggestion is that if Jennings the valet had actually done it, what would a valet know more than what was in Sir James's clothing? If he were the one who had done it, why wouldn't he have also changed the time in the watch in his pocket?
Yeah, he would know to tamper with the golf watch. Our final little button here, Mr. Satterthwaite says, "Oh, I was all wrong. I thought that you would come to save them, these two lovers." And Mr. Quinn is like, "Oh, no, I totally did save two lovers, not those two, the others." This is what he says. "Perhaps you didn't notice the lady's maid. She wasn't wearing blue brocade or acting a dramatic part, but she's really a very pretty girl, and I think she loves that man Jennings very much. I think that between you, you'll be able to save her man from getting hanged." So he did save his lovers after all, didn't he, Catherine?
I know, it's very sweet of Mr. Quinn.
And yeah, I mean, I think that within the greater Christie of the story is most significant, perhaps, for being a precursor to Murder at the Vicarage. And you know what? This is actually just coming to me as I say this. When was the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection published? 1931?
30.
When was Murder at the Vicarage? Was that 1930?
Yeah, 1930.
So this is just coming to me as I'm discussing this, but I think perhaps that is the reason that this story wasn't included in the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection. Maybe not, but just hear me out for a second. Perhaps it would be a little awkward for the story that so clearly mirrors the Murder at the Vicarage plot to come out within the Mysterious Mr. Quinn collection the very same year that Murder at the Vicarage came out.
No, it's a really valid point. I hadn't thought about that before either, but no, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
Because I stick to how I felt at the beginning of this episode. I think this is a fantastic Mr. Quinn, Mr. Satterthwaite story. I don't think there's any valid reason for this not to be within that collection, except for that. And I do get that, because it's pretty obvious. And if you had, as a reader, just bought one of them and then bought the other months apart or whatever, you'd be like, hey, wait a second. You know, it's one thing when it's in a magazine and it's a couple of years apart, but if you're paying for two books and it feels so, you know, duplicative like that, that could potentially be an issue.
Yeah, it's funny. It hadn't occurred to me that they were the same year, but they are. I like the short story, but then again, I'm a sucker for the Mr. Quinn stories.
I know. I feel like we have no critical distance from these stories anymore because we've just fallen head over heels in love.
I mean, I will say this is a lesser one to me, but you know, it's still very enjoyable.
I actually hear you a little bit on how it's tonally weird. Ironically, it's tonally weird in that it's not that weird.
Right. No, that's exactly it. You know, you get no spooky Mr. Quinn in it.
Mm-hmm.
He's also seen by everybody.
Yep, he's seen by everybody. Like, sure, there's the car accident, but even so, he's not appearing out of nowhere or disappearing over a cliff. There's no weird 20s hipster who's getting strangled by, you know, a guitar string. It's all just, you know, a very standard murder with a very standard solution.
Right. And Mr. Quinn seems like an actual person who they met on the road. There's nothing particularly mysterious about him in this.
Yeah, no, it's true. I'm pretty happy with that hypothesis, too. And you know what? Fair enough. I think that sacrificing the love detective / at the crossroads for the sake of Murder at the Vicarage is a sacrifice worth making.
I agree. Although I have to say, I find the name change to the love detectives rather weird.
It is weird. I think it's coming just from a place of this story is just floating around on its own. So it's getting a very general descriptive title at that point, since they have been described as the love detectives before for obvious reasons. So the title doesn't really have anything to do with this story specifically, which is jarring. I agree with that.
Yeah. Also, it has a certain ode to Parker Pine to it.
Just in title only. Yes.
Yes, correct.
Right. Heart specialist.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
That's true. Mr. Quinn and Mr. Satterthwaite just never disappoint, do they?
They really don't. I know that some listeners haven't read all of those. In fact, a lot of people haven't read all of those. We hadn't before we started this podcast, probably. And
I certainly hadn't read this one. That's right. I had read
The Mysterious Mr. Quinn. Right.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, this is an outlier one, and I think they're all worth reading.
Absolutely. We, in fact, even wrote a little piece that features on the official Agatha Christie website to that effect, if anyone is interested in checking it out. So that is the Love Detectives. We do have one Mr. Quinn and Mr. Satterthwaite short story left. Do not despair. We would love for you to join us next time when we will be discussing a novel. Catherine Brobeck, what shall it be?
They Do It With Mirrors.
Not to be confused with The Mirror Cracked or The Mirror Cracked From Side to Side, because we certainly do confuse it.
Yeah, I know.
So it's probably worth mentioning.
And also we mentioned The Lady of Shalott even in this episode, so you can't blame us.
And also not to be confused with Dead Man's Mirror, which we covered recently, but it's not surprising that Christie has mirror in the titles of so many of her mysteries. So I'm actually really excited for that, Miss Marple. I remember it fondly, even though I do not remember whodunit. That is the best of both worlds.
I know. You know what? I also remember it and also do not remember the outcome. So it will be interesting.
Please feel free to email us at allaboutthedame@gmail.com. You can also find us on our Patreon site. We've welcomed a bunch of new patrons recently, and we would love to have as many as possible. We're always discussing all things Agatha Christie related, some outlier texts for the completists among you, as well as some film offerings and just all sorts of fun to be had over there. So that's at www.patreon.com/allaboutagatha. We are on Twitter at All About The Dame. Catherine is on Twitter at Brobcat. Our Facebook page is All About Agatha, and our Instagram handle is at All About Agatha. And we would really appreciate it if you took a moment to rate and review us. If you haven't already done so, it really helps us out. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.